This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is March 26, 2020, and this is episode 182.
I'm Scott DeLunnebaum.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, we look at the responses to COVID-19 from the economic angle with Kevin Milligan and the political angle with Stuart Prest. It's a jammed-packed episode. First, though, we have to thank those who continue to help make the show possible. We're up to 91 contributors each month. We gained one new patron named Ian, not me, in the past couple weeks. And we're now at $272 US a month, which is great. That, I think, just about covers our new editing contract with CHLY Nanaimo. In particular, thanks to everyone who's able to stick with us through these difficult and trying times. We definitely understand if some of you may need to put a pause on your support for a couple months. Just give us a heads up. We want you to look after yourself and your families first.
And as we announced last week, for the duration of the crisis, we've decided to open up the Slack that's normally just for our patrons to all our listeners. And you can head over to legandbootmedia.ca for the form to request an invite.
As well, most days I've been watching the BC press conferences to give my days some kind of routine. And while I watch those updates with Bonnie Henry, Adrian Dix, and any others that come up, I've been live tweeting them at Politicoast Pod. So find our Twitter account there, follow us, retweet us. And I try not to make too many mistakes, unlike the real journalists who do it much better. But, you know, it's fun. And of course, Politicoast is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to politicstoday.news/free-trial. And if you go to that website, you'll find a few of Shannon's pieces that they've released for free and are worth reading. And it's worth getting that trial because her coverage is nonstop through these very dark times. So, BC Today, politicstoday.news. Well, thank you, Kevin Milligan, for joining us once again on Politicoast.
My pleasure to be here. Happy to talk over these economic times with you.
Yeah, it's a little more fun, I guess, or a little less fun, I guess, doing it all isolated from each other.
Yeah, it's more fun to be there in person, but I don't think any of this is fun right now.
No, it really isn't. These are pretty uncertain times, but that's what brought you on to discuss. So, I mean, everyone's well aware of what's happening with the coronavirus. It seems to be the only thing that anyone can talk about at all. But as part of the impacts of that, there's been a rather unprecedented economic response. And it's almost like we're trying to put the economy into a medically induced coma. And that's causing a whole bunch of things to happen and governments to respond in a bunch of different ways. So that's why we brought you on to discuss what's happening and how the governments are responding to the situation.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about it. I think maybe a good place to start is just talking about the magnitude of what we're looking at. And I can start that with a little anecdote. 1 week ago today, which is like a decade ago in pandemic time, but 1 week ago, last Thursday, I was talking to a national newspaper reporter and asked me, hey, how bad is this going to be for the labor market? My answer was, you know, it's likely going to be the worst one-month drop since the 1930s. And in fact, it might even be the worst in recorded economic history. So the reporter went back, came back to me 2 hours later and said, my editor bounced that, not credible. And so then the next day, that Friday, 6 days ago, by noon, that was conventional wisdom. So, and now we see, you know, I think if I were to say this is going to be the worst quarter in recorded economic history, I don't think I'd have anyone who would say I'm wrong.
Right. So to kind of put some rough numbers on it, what I've seen is about 900,000 to a million people have applied for EI already. And that's kind of just the first week of numbers we got. Is that about right?
Yeah, that's the numbers that I saw. You know, they're expecting within a few weeks to have something like 3 million people on the new emergency benefit that we'll talk about maybe in a few minutes. But I think, you know, a jump, our labor force is around 19 million. And I think a month from now to expect that to maybe 4 million of those to be unemployed that weren't last week is not out of the bounds of possibility.
So how do we even grapple with this? Like how does the average person try to get their mind around this, let alone economists? Because I can't imagine there are models for what to do.
There are not models for what to do. Many economists, macroeconomists, look at the patterns of recessions and see how, you know, you can see it smooth up and then it hits and then we get out of it. And those kind of dynamics are the meat and potatoes of macroeconomics. But there's never been anything that's hit so quickly before. And so, you know, trying to understand what it will look like on the other side is even difficult. Now, in terms of, you know, my area of research, which is looking at, you know, income support policies and tax policies, there, everything we knew about how to try to design these policies has been turned on its head. Specifically, you know, we spend a lot of time trying to think about how do we design policies that support people, but, you know, make sure that they have lots of incentive to work and that they get to, you know, keep their earnings. And so they want to work harder. This is what we try to do. In this case, you know, the goal is almost the opposite of that, that we want people to sit at home and we're just trying to figure out how to support them. And if it turns out that more people are sitting at home than weren't, then maybe that was actually the goal of the policy. So it's really, very bizarre to think about. Yeah.
Yeah. So like most of the time when a recession happens, it's because something went wrong with the economy. There's a demand shock, a supply shock. But this one is really different in the fact that it's pretty much an intentional recession being caused deliberately by policymakers as a side effect of trying to combat the COVID-19, which I suppose puts it in a lot more different space in terms of how to think about this.
Yeah, the fact that it's intentional is really bizarre, and it's intentional for a good reason here, the reasons of public health, and it's not that I would object to those at all. Those are important reasons, and we have to fight the health crisis first. But the fact that we are like choosing to constrain our labor supply, it makes us very weird that we are trying to make sure that our economy generates enough income so that we can survive when we are on our own holding back how much people can work.
So what are the, before we get into the specifics of what's being laid out, like there are a number of big challenges in facing all levels of government in terms of responding to this. What do you see as the biggest challenges, both in like the short term being like the next, I guess, week before the end of the month, and then like the midterm of the next couple months?
The overall framework that I take to this challenge is that what we're trying to do is to build a bridge for our economy to the other side of the health crisis. And when you think about it that way, it makes it different than the normal discussions. Oh, we're in a recession. We should do stimulus through monetary policy. We should do stimulus through fiscal policy, because any of those tools is meant to generate more economic activity. And that's not our goal right now. Our goal is to kind of press pause on the economy for a few weeks, a few months, whatever it's going to be, and then try to unpause it on the other side. So building that bridge is the goal. Thinking about that, we have to do a few things. Number one, which we've seen already, is big movement by the Bank of Canada to back up the financial sector so that it does not freeze up and we don't add to our crisis here a big financial crisis. That would be a big problem. The Bank of Canada has acted quickly on that to make sure that our banks are well supported. So that was kind of an immediate crisis. Number two is family incomes. The people, the millions of Canadians who are being laid off and thrown out of work now, they need income to support their families through the next few months. And so putting that in place, and there's been a lot of movement on that over the past week in terms of policy at both the federal and provincial level. And the third thing is our businesses. When we get to the other side, we want to have shops to go to buy things. And we also want to have businesses that are active enterprises there to employ people. And beyond businesses, also other kinds of organizations like the not-for-profit and charity sector and cultural sector and everything. We just need, on the other side, places that are able to ramp up their hiring and ramp up their economic activity on the other side. So individuals have to survive, but also our organizations have to survive. And so we have to use the policy tools we have available to build that bridge.
Well, let's jump into what those policy tools are. Over the past week and a bit, both provincially and federally, a lot has been rolled out. But let's start with what's happening at the federal level and Canada's economic response plan.
With the federal level, what we've seen and now has been passed through Parliament and almost ready to roll, is a lot of supports for individuals in a couple of ways. One is to, you know, make sure that families get across the bridge by giving them some more income now, but also shifting some of their expenses to the future, so deferring some of their bills. So on the income side, there's a new Canada Emergency Relief Benefit, Response Benefit, CERB. There is that to provide income to people who've been laid off. There have been announced increases, one-time increases to the Canada Child Benefit and the GST tax credit. They won't arrive till May, but those are dollars that will be going out the door, $7.5 billion worth. It's not small. And then as well, for the family level, there are deferments of your tax payments aren't going to be owed until later in the year. And also things like student loans, they can be deferred. And the federal government, working with the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation and working with the big banks, has set up a way that individuals can try to defer their mortgage payments. I don't know anyone who's successfully done that yet, but I understand that it's working, that people have been able to set up arrangements to defer mortgage payments. And that's all been done at the federal level to try to, you know, increase money in and decrease money out such that families are able to pay their basics to survive the next few months.
Right. So this is basically cutting everyone who's affected a check, more or less, to keep them liquid, to have some money to cover the basic necessities. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's the idea. You know, the emergency response benefit that was just passed through Parliament this week, you know, it's going to give $500 a week or $2,000 a month to people who've lost their job. You don't have to qualify for EI if you're someone who is self-employed, if you're someone who didn't have the full hours that you normally have to qualify for EI. You can still be eligible for this benefit. There's a website that's supposed to be ready by early April, and you would apply through that website and start getting checks within a few weeks. I have a growing amount of confidence they're going to be able to pull that off and have that application work. Millions of people are going to be applying, but they're doing this through the Canada Revenue Agency, which you'll remember handles a huge deluge of tax filing every April. So they can handle millions of us applying for taxes on a couple of days at the end of April every year. They should have the computer servers and the capacity to handle a couple million applications for this new benefit. So I have a growing amount of confidence that will work, and that will give $500 a week delivered from the CRA direct deposit into people's accounts arriving in April.
I was going to say, that's an optimism that, given the recent experiences with, the Phoenix Pay system. but let's be optimistic. We need reasons for optimism.
The Phoenix Pay system, yeah. Yeah, I really did have a bit more concern about that until I walked through in my head a bit that this is the CRA doing it, and the fact that they had that surge capacity from the regular annual tax filing cycle, that they're going to have the computer side of it there. And also in terms of the complexity of this benefit, they tried, and we'll see when we see the website, they tried to strip the complexity out of it as much as they could. It's a flat benefit of $500 a week. There's no complicated formulas. Furthermore, the application, you apparently are going to have like a checkbox that you attest that you are eligible for it. And so you just kind of say, yep, I'm eligible. I read the rules. You check the box and you get the money. That's what they've said they're going to do. Now, you know, how are they going to check on that? Well, you know, 12 months later, when you file your 2020 taxes, if you, you know, said you're out of work and you, but you claim you made $200,000, then maybe they're going to have something to say about your checkbox that you did back in April. But, you know, the basic idea is at the point of entry to this, they're trying to make it as simple as possible. They have the computer capacity there at the CRA. I have some confidence that they're going to be able to deliver.
Right. That checkbox thing, I think it's important because one of the first criticisms I saw of the two previous payment systems they were proposing was they seemed a bit leaky. Like they were a situation where a lot of people or a significant number of people might still fall through the cracks. And so are you more confident that, like, I've seen it said that this is a situation where it's better to pay too many people than too few?
Yeah, that's what I see here, that with the checkbox, with the what looks like are going to be fairly clear criteria, and those criteria are that if you've made at least $5,000 in the previous 12 months, you'll be eligible to apply for this benefit. And so you have to have worked. This isn't going to work for someone who is, you know, retired. They can't apply for this. This is for workers who are thrown out of work because of the crisis. The way they're going to determine whether you're thrown out of work is you earned $5,000 in the previous 12 months. That's a pretty low bar. I mean, if you're working even part-time, you'll be eligible for this. Part-time enough that you made $5,000. So, you know, that's pretty a low bar of entry, and I hope they're able to achieve that with the website. And you're right, the last week, which is again a decade ago in COVID-19 time, they had originally announced two separate benefits that were going to be done kind of much more looking like EI than what this benefit is. And so they've streamlined it, put it into one, made it delivered by the CRA, and I think there's a good chance to deliver. And, you know, if they don't deliver on this, then we got to hold them accountable for it, because this is really important for millions of Canadian families.
Right. So what's interesting to me about this is that it's just a simple check going out to everyone. It's clear they just want to push money out as quickly as possible. But, you know, in past recessions, you've often seen responses that rely more on in-kind benefits rather than simple cash. Is this kind of a change in how the government's looking at support during recessions?
Yeah, I think it comes again to the goal that they're trying to do. They're not going to be pushing out job training. They're not going to be pushing out other kinds of things, because the goal here is just to bridge family incomes to the other side of the crisis. Ideally, many of the people who are laid off will go back to the same firm when we get to the other side, when it's safe to do so. So specifically, one part of the new benefit that I think is a great feature is that you don't even actually have to be legally laid off with a record of employment and the whole legal separation from the firm. The firm can just put you on furlough. Furlough just means, you know, you're not coming into work. You're on like unpaid leave, which is important for two reasons. Number one, on the other side of the crisis, they just unfurlough you. They call you into work and you start working again. There's no paperwork. There's no, you know, there's no onboarding process. But the second thing is that why that's important is if you're on furlough, you can potentially keep your benefits. And, you know, in Canada, we have, employer paid benefits like supplemental health plans or other kinds of benefits that can be important for you. While you're on leave, you might be able to keep those. Now, it might depend on your employer whether they're willing to keep those benefits rolling while you're on furlough, but that option is there, which I think is important. I think some firms will be able to take advantage of that and keep that continuity of employer-employee matches, as economists say. And that's important because regenerating those employer-employee matches can be expensive if you have to look around for a new job. The more we can just onboard people to the same firms and the same matches they had before, the smoother the other side of this will be.
Right. So one thing I've seen from a bunch of European countries, Denmark's been the one that's thrown around the most, but also I believe the UK and the Netherlands are covering somewhere between 70 to 90% of people's salaries, often with a cap, whereas here we're only doing a 10% cap. Can you kind of explain the difference in approaches and why we're doing it one way and a lot of European countries are doing it the other?
Yeah, I've looked at the UK and the Danish models, and both for both of them, what they're doing is kind of very similar, actually, to the CERB, the Canada Emergency Relief Benefit. In that, to be eligible for that, you know, for the Danish model, it has to be someone who's not working. This is for workers who are about to be laid off. The deal is that the government pays 75% of your salary, and the firm covers the other 25% of your salary, and you get paid by the firm. So you essentially just stay on the payroll. So you're just not coming into work. You're on the payroll. You get your regular paycheck, but the government covers 75% of your salary by paying a check to the firm. So why is that good? That's good because it maintains that employer-employee match so that on the other side, you can just onboard these people very quickly. It gives people substantial income support. If they're getting a big part of their income, they stay on payroll. That's great. So compare that to what we're doing here. We're allowing you to do the same kind of thing where you can be on furlough. Now you're only getting $2,000 flat a month. In both the UK and Denmark, for higher earners, you know, what you're going to get is 75% of your salary is more than $2,000 a month. So we're not going to be compensating as much the more middle and higher earners. But there's not that much difference in the models. Now, what you mentioned, Scott, was the 10% subsidy that's also part of the package. What that is for workers who are still working, the government will cut a check to the firm for 10% of your payroll. So that's a very different thing, right? That's for workers who are still working. So that 10% subsidy is for those who are still working. It shouldn't be compared to the Danish thing. The Danish thing and the UK thing are for workers who are not working at the time. So it's a very different thing. Now, that 10% wage subsidy is I think, a good thing to be doing. It only applies to small businesses and is capped at $25,000 total per firm. And there's been a lot of calls from the small business community and the middle and big business community to ramp that up, make it more than 10%, get rid of that $25,000 cap, or at least make it a lot bigger, with the goal of providing some incentive to firms not to put people over to this new benefit, but to actually keep them working. I think we could most likely do some of both, keep the emergency relief benefit for those who are not working, but also ramp up a bit this subsidy for those who are able to keep their jobs so that firms can keep people employed.
Okay. Well, the other couple of things the federal government's doing, which we'll briefly touch on before moving on to what's happening in BC, is they're extending credit in a bunch of programs to various businesses to help keep them afloat, as well as, I believe it was $55 billion in tax deferrals, basically letting them pay taxes later. Is that correct?
That's right. So both at the individual and corporate levels, they're allowing the taxes that would be owed now to be deferred to later in the year. Again, that just frees up your cash flow right now, that if you don't have the big bills to pay now, you don't need as much income now, and that makes it a bit better. But that helps both individuals and firms. But on the corporate side, we talked about the 10% payroll subsidy. There is these deferrals that have been put forward. And there's also expansions of loan capacity through the Business Development Bank, and also just by loosening bank regulations, allowing the big banks to loan out more to firms. The idea there is that firms, big, small, and medium, can borrow money to get themselves over the hump of the next few months, and that the borrowing from the big banks will be easier because of the greater lending capacity that they've been afforded through these changes in regulations. Now, this is, I think, a weakness of the federal plan so far. Allowing firms to take on a bunch of debt they're going to have a hard time paying off in the future is not going to be easy. So if you're a restaurant, you know, you're shut down now, and you still got to pay your rent, you still have to pay your loan payments for your equipment and other things. Those payments are fixed. When we get to the other side of this, you know, even if you've been able to defer some of those payments, you're just going to have a big load of debt to pay off. And that's not going to be easy for many small and medium-sized businesses. So I think there needs to be some more relief there for businesses. And again, it's not because I think we ought to be doing corporate welfare or making life easy for fat cats. This is just about allowing our organizations to survive to the other side. We can talk about what tax rates we ought to apply to people and their profits in the future. that's not the point here. The point here is we need employers and active organizations available to ramp up on the other side. And if we let a big part of our corporate sector go bankrupt over the next couple months, that's going to make this from, you know, a blip in the economy to something that could last a long time.
Right, because it's better to keep everyone going now and sort out the debt problem after than try and not do anything at the moment.
That's the idea. I mean, we could, you know, just tell Air Canada and WestJet to shut down now and start up, you know, Scott and Ian and Kevin's airline on the other side. But let's face it, we have no clue how to run an airline, right? So we actually need someone to run an airline on the other side. And it makes sense that we would use WestJet and Air Canada. We might need to restructure those companies. We might need to have some loans. We might have to wipe out shareholders. I don't know, but we actually need like the HR department and the marketing department there so we can get an airline up and going so we can actually fly around when we get to the other side. It's going to be like that across the corporate sector, that they're going to be taking on debt and difficult decisions, but we can't just wipe the slate clean and try to start again from you know, a blank piece of paper. We need to keep our organizations. And that's true not just for the corporate sector, but also our charities and our not-for-profit sector. They're not just providing services through this crisis, but we need them there on the other side to ramp up as well. And their revenues have dried up and their expenses are continuing. And so we need to see a continuity plan for them as well.
Yeah, as someone who works in the nonprofit sector, it's a massive hit. I know a lot of organizations have had to cancel their major spring galas that are typically, you know, $10,000 to $50,000 income events that they rely on. And I've seen some organizations put out these desperate emails. I saw one in the UK is looking at a £250,000 shortfall where they would otherwise have a small surplus. So it's a big challenge. If you have some money, I should say to everyone out there, like, I'm actually not doing too bad. We're a two-income household that's both okay. So it's a good time to sprinkle any extra wealth you have around if you have it. And don't feel bad if you don't. Take the government money. But let's move over to the British Columbia side and look at what our province is doing to essentially top up the federal government. The first bill they passed was a couple changes to sick leave to basically give people with COVID-19 related reasons for missing work the ability to take indefinite sick leave or an indefinite unpaid leave, and to actually put into law finally that anyone in BC can have 3 days unpaid sick leave. There's that, and then there's the $5 billion plan, the backbone of which is this one-time top up of $1,000 to the federal CERB we were talking about.
Yeah. When we think about what's going on in BC, I think it's important to recognize that we're a federal country and we have provinces and we have the federal government. And I know that's a source of frustration sometimes. People get worried about the overlap and the squabbles, but I really see in this crisis, it can be a source of great strength for us. And the reason for that is the different levels and orders of government can focus on what's on their agenda. And so the federal government is focusing on the income support, getting the Bank of Canada stuff right, getting the Business Development Bank and all those federal issues, working hard on those. Provincial government has a different set of issues and they are fully seized with those. So they are in charge, the provincial government, number one, with our health system, which is obviously important in a health crisis. But also, as you mentioned, Ian, the labor market regulation is mostly done at the provincial level. So rules about sick leave and employee-employee relationships are all governed by provincial legislation. Furthermore, landlord-tenant act stuff differs across provinces. And so that's why we saw yesterday announced the a package for tenants and renters that was put out there to try to figure out what to do with, you know, rents that are due on April 1st coming up in just a few days. So that's why, you know, people wanted perhaps some federal action on that. I really thought it was appropriate for provinces to do that because the rental market and rental legislation is different in every province. And so trying to imagine how Ottawa can figure out how BC landlord-tenant legislation works is not the right way to go. Doing this provincially is the right way to go. Federal government can, you know, help out by delivering big checks to the provincial governments and delivering checks to individuals. What the provincial government can do is figure out the right match of policies for our situation here in BC.
And do you think they've got that match pretty good, or has there been too much stepping on each other's toes?
I've seen some good coordination. So for the income supports that the provincial government announced earlier this week, you know, as you mentioned, the top up to the EI or the, you know, the emergency relief benefit, the provincial government's going to top that up by $1,000, which is, I think, a good move. They're also going to top up the BC Climate Action Tax Credit. That won't be delivered till later in the year. I think it was June or something. It's a bit later on, but it will be there. It'll be a few hundred dollars per family, which is good. That's good coordination there. Those things are going to be delivered by the CRA through direct deposit. The federal government has the machinery to do that, and I think that's great coordination. In terms of the other policies that provincial government announced, again, things in their bailiwick, which is, you know, things like ICBC payments and BC Hydro payments and more license renewal payments, and for businesses, PST remittances and employer health tax remittances, and all of these things that are, you know, in the sphere of the provincial government, deferring many of these things, changing many of these things to try to make things easier for people to make ends meet over the next couple of months. But big part of the package was yesterday, which is the renters package. I don't know a lot about housing policy. I did note that it was received, I'd say, a lukewarm reception on Twitter anyway, what I saw about it. You know, the idea is that there's a freeze on evictions related to non-payment of rent, but they left some wiggle room there that you can still do an eviction if a tenant is behaving badly, like, you know, some kind of physical damage or threats or whatever, the regular kind of things you might want to evict for. But just trying to make sure that you couldn't be evicted because you lost your job. And that was, I'm not sure whether it's just a temporary moratorium for the next few weeks or whether we extended it into April and May, but that was one part of it.
I believe with that one that it is for the duration of the declaration of emergency.
Oh, okay.
So, it'll probably last as long as the emergency declaration is in effect.
And I thought that was a nice way to do. I really do think it was appropriate to do an eviction, a freeze for that reason. But you need to have some wiggle room because there are going to be, you know, some cases that, you know, are appropriate to still continue in the regular way. Like, you know, in the case of someone damaging a property or something like that. At the same time, some have pushed for a full-on, you know, rent holiday, and there should be no one should have to pay rent. That would be a very challenging thing to do, and the reason is, on the other side of that transaction are a lot of people who are expecting rent checks. Now, you might like to think that it's, you know, the guy from the Monopoly board with the top hat who's just counting all his fat checks coming in. I suppose there might be some of those people who are landlords, but come on. We all know people who have a rental condo and they're not actually wearing a top hat. They're, you know, just regular folks with a rental condo, and they kind of need that payment coming in. We also have seniors who are relying on this as their sole source of income sometimes. And so, you know, it's not so easy necessarily just to say no one should have to pay rent. So I think...
Yeah, Joe, like what would happen would pretty much be it would cause a mini financial crisis within the real estate economy here in BC, right?
Yeah.
Which would have a bunch of problems associated with it, yeah. Which would then make everything else harder to tackle.
Right. Now, what I really hope, and this is something I think consistent with what the premier was saying, you know, I hope that landlords will talk to their tenants in the next few days, and if someone is going to be in trouble, they can arrange a deferral of some kind. You know, arrangements could be made. In the absence of that, there was some provision for a $500 emergency payment that could be arranged. I'm not sure how they're going to get all that done in the next 5 days, but
it's not happening in March. They've said it's going to be sometime in April.
Yeah.
By the time that gets out.
And I fully appreciate the need out there for people who are struggling and someone lost their job or for whatever reason, they're not going to be in a great situation if they have a rent check due at the end of the month. And I understand that need, but I also understand the challenges that are faced by any government, a provincial government, a federal government, in trying to erect a policy that's legal for them to do, that they have a legislative framework within a matter of days, is a challenge that even the nimblest of government would have a hard time fulfilling. So, I don't think they've satisfied everyone on this. I don't think it was possible to satisfy everyone on this.
I think that last point about just the, you know, scope of the challenge and the timeline, it's so underappreciated in that most policies take a long time to roll out. I saw someone talking about, it wasn't you, was it? The building the Canada Child Benefit?
Yeah, I did talk about that. You know, watching that go into place, I you know, back in 2014-15, I had a hand in putting together the design of the Canada Child Benefit that the federal Liberals then put in place after they won the election. Okay, so, you know, I worked on some spreadsheets, we did some costing models, the kind of economist-y kind of stuff you would do. So then they won the election, and, you know, I'm here in Vancouver, they were off running the government. I had occasional talks with them, but I wasn't, like, hands-on. But what I heard back from them was their initial meeting they had with the bureaucracies, that they go in, and the clerk of the Privy Council says, congratulations on winning the election. Here's our plan for implementing your promises. And they were told that it would take years to implement the Canada Child Benefit, because they wanted to test out the CRA system, and they wanted to test out this, and they wanted to make sure it integrated with provincial things. And so they had a plan that would have was scheduled for years. Now, the new government, as they took power, this is back in 2015-16, said, no, we don't want years. We want it July 1st, 2016. As it turns out, they were able to get that done, and that was a six-month timeline. And when I heard this anecdotes over beers a few months later after that, they were all very proud of themselves. They're like, yeah, we got it done in 6 months. Ha-ha. They told us it would take years, and we got it done in 6 months. Well, now fast forward to the situation we're facing now. You know, there's no high fives and pub anecdotes about a six-month story. They literally had 6 days to design a policy that 3 million Canadians were going to be applying for. And so just in terms of getting the legislation right and then the policy design, getting the servers in place, all of those things are at a speed that is entirely unprecedented that I've never seen the policy world have to deal with before. So, you know, I hope they got it right. I think they did a pretty good job on the income support side. But just the that they pulled all this together in the space of a couple of weeks is astounding.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's like the initial idea I had at one point is just send the check to everyone who filed income tax, or like Ralph Bucks happened a number of years ago. Everyone who filed their income taxes got an extra payment, but that still leaves people out. There's, I think Dr. Jennifer Robson had a good thread on Twitter about how long that could even take. And so I think things like topping up the climate action credit, topping up child benefit, which honestly is going to help me and we don't need, but topping up GST, these are well-established infrastructures that will get money flowing. Unfortunately, it's next month. And that's where I think, you know, saying no evictions, it's, you know what the secret is there? That does mean it's a rent holiday for anyone who doesn't want to pay because your landlord can't kick you out. You still will have to pay it eventually, but they can't kick you out.
Yeah, so part of it there is with the income plan to come in April and May from these new benefits, you know, hopefully people will be able to, you know, reconcile their rent ledgers when the new money comes in. Maybe that will help out. You know, that's what they were able to do. In terms of the idea of just why can't we just cut a check to everyone rather than fiddle around with all of these different programs, the honest answer is it would actually be no faster. I mean, when you think about how you actually deliver a flat payment to everyone, you have to do it through some database. And the best database we have in terms of giving stuff out to families is like the GST tax credit and the Canada Child Tax Benefit databases, because they're all already updated for people who've been born and people who've died and people who've moved out of the country. Those databases are geared for regular payments. They're up to date and they're, you know, pretty much ready to go. But even with those databases, it will take weeks to get the programming done and do the testing and make sure it's ready to go, because, you know, you don't want to make a decimal mistake when you're sending out 3 million checks. You know, do they really test these and make sure they're secure? And so even a flat payment, what looks very simple, takes weeks in the space of getting something done when you're doing it at the scale of the federal government. And that's really frustrating. Everyone wants to get this out as soon as possible. There's no one who does not want to get it out. You know, my strong sense of the federal government and the people in the prime minister's office is they're not sitting around saying, you know, what's best for our poll numbers if we give this money out in April versus May? That's not the decision here. I strongly suspect they would give up body parts to get it out in April rather than May, and March better than April. But I, you know, you can't make the server crunch faster than it does. And, you know, you go into war with the army you have rather than the army that you'd like to have. And the, you know, the army we have in this case is the delivery mechanisms that we already have, which is the Canada Child Benefit, the GST tax credit, and the CRA servers that will help us out with the new relief benefit. And frustrating for everyone, people really need the income now. That's what we have.
Okay. Well, coming up on time, but before we go, we've talked a lot about everything that's coming out of the government here, but and nobody's really talking about this, but we should probably mention it, that eventually this money has to come from somewhere. Kind of, what are the options for how we cover what's going to probably end up being a very sizable percent of GDP that's getting picked up by the governments here? And I guess to put it in the context of the memes that are going around, can we just set the money printer to go burr and just send out all the money?
Yeah, I think the right way to conceive of this is very similar to World War II, when we took on a lot of debt and then paid it off over the next decades. We took on that debt to fight a mortal enemy. And it's the same thing here. The idea that we should use a lot of resources now as a temporary measure to get over this crisis is, I think, the right framework, and I think what we ought to do. The actual way to do it, the money goes burr meme, is perhaps thinking of just printing a lot of dollar bills or something, or printing a lot of money. I don't know that's necessary to go that way. We can just borrow the money. The interest rate on government debt right now is around 1%. To put that in context, if we take on $100 billion of debt, that costs us 1%, which is $1 billion a year to service. For the federal government, $1 billion a year is not actually that much. That would be 1/10 of a GST point. So in other words, if we borrowed $100 billion to get through this crisis, the permanent cost to us was the GST would have to go from 5 to 5.1%. That's not horrible. I mean, I'd rather not. GST staying at 5 sounds good to me, but 5.1 is not going to be like something that is a great burden on the economy forever. Now, that's if we borrow $100 billion. I'm not sure it's only going to be $100 billion. I'm, in fact, pretty sure it's going to be more than that. But you get a sense of the magnitude there. We will be able to borrow the money, and it will cost us a bit more in the long run. But what's the alternative? We don't have an alternative. So even if it were a bit more dollars, we got to do this to get not just our public health to the other side of the crisis. We have to do this so that when we get to the other side, we can, you know, get our economy up and running again.
Okay, well, I think we're definitely going to have to bring you back to talk about this again, because all of these policies are developing very rapidly, and there's so many more angles we could still go down to.
And we haven't even touched on the recovery once we've start to unpause the situation. So there'll be plenty to talk about.
That's going to be a fascinating thing to see how easy it is to press unpause and ramp the economy back up. And there's going to be a lot of policy discussions then as well. I'd be very happy to talk to you on the other side. I do think we're going to get there. We're going to bend the curve, and we're going to get through this. We're going to be taking on a lot of debt over the next few months, but I think we can do it.
Okay. Well, Kevin Milligan, thank you for joining us tonight on Play Coast.
My pleasure.
Before you go, can you just let our listeners know where they can find you?
Yeah, my Twitter handle is at Kevin Milligan. You can also find me by Googling me up. I'm at UBC. And have a look and have a follow.
Thank you. Well, we're now joined by Stuart Prest to talk, I guess, a bit more about the political angles that are happening and some of the higher level questions. But I think before we even get to that, how are we all doing? How's everyone doing? Are you okay?
Doing all right. Holding things together. I got more or less figured out how to do interviews. Well, I did interviews from home before, but now I'm doing lectures from home, and that's a bit of a trick. And doing lectures from home while there are small children in the house is another little wrinkle, but we're getting it all sorted out.
Yeah, this is a golden time for those kids interrupting interview videos.
It happens often enough, it's not even news anymore.
No.
And here I am, like, having worked from home for several years and had my partner and baby home for the last 6 months. And so it's technically not changed substantially, other than there's nowhere to go anymore. So we all get a bit squirrely inside.
I did. I had 5 hours of lecture today, which is a lot, but I also had an hour. So the one class was an hour, another class was a four-hour lecture thing, which is something SFU does, which is another story entirely. But the break, 15 minutes of just silence where I was, it was really nice. And not to be inundated by any noise or anything, I quite enjoyed it.
Yeah, so I've been stuck at home for the past nearly 2 weeks now, just coming off of a bad cough, but feeling better and just kind of following the public health recommendations of doing a full 14-day self-isolation for any symptoms, but feeling better. Well, looking forward to actually going grocery shopping and stepping out of my apartment for a change.
Just wash your hands lots before and after.
Just be aware things are different out there now.
Yeah, it's going to be super weird. Just the last time I left my apartment, it was just as things were starting to get serious, like right when the NBA was canceling everything and just before the various emergencies started to be declared. So it's going to be kind of weird, kind of going into isolation and then coming out 2 weeks later into a much different Vancouver.
Well, that's you and Justin Trudeau, I guess, because he went into his self-isolation 2 weeks ago when Sophie Gregoire Trudeau was diagnosed with COVID. And so they'll both be, you'll all be coming out at the same time into a much different world. But to start to explore that world and how politically it's changed, Stuart, with your background in just political science and international relations, I thought we could do a little bit more of a discussion about how this crisis is kind of maybe reminding people of what the role of government is, or maybe we can like talk about what is the role of government in a crisis? It's kind of my first launching question.
Sure. Well, we have, we tend to think of government in a modern liberal democratic state. There's this real tension between we want to have the trappings of everyday modern life, but we also want to have the freedoms that we've come to enjoy, provided to the greatest extent possible. So we want to have what amounts to, in some ways, the miracle of the modern state to deliver all this kind of care to us and to ensure that we can live in our teeming millions in relatively close proximity and get everything we need to survive and relatively able to go out and to a greater or lesser extent trust that when we step outside, things are going to work. But we also want to have this maximized rights, set of rights, freedom, speech, movement, and whatnot. And when we get into a situation in which people's security is threatened, all that starts to change a little bit. They start to look for the state to be more aggressive in its interventions and to do, we hear, whatever it takes is more often said, to ensure that the more fundamental elements of our needs are met. So it's not about expression and that so much as just providing for basic safety. And that can take on a much larger role in our lives. And so this, we're going to start to hear more about this debate, I think, in the coming weeks, is just how much more intervention, how much more intrusive are we willing to accept a state to be over the short and the long term to safeguard our lives, our livelihoods, our security of person and whatnot in the face of what we're now calling a new normal. It feels like we've had a number of moments of new normal, but this is a new normal where we actually have to change our behaviors. And now we have to figure out, well, how much more power do we want to transfer to the state? We see extremes in places like Taiwan and South Korea and so on, compared to what we are experiencing here in terms of the state actually keeping tabs on the population through things like cell data and so on. And whereas we're used to thinking of people holding government to account, there's going to be this new front in some states, at least, where the state holds the people to account to make sure that everyone is doing what is expected of them to ward off this new threat, this new significant threat.
Right. We're starting to see that a bit here in Canada. Earlier, I think it was today, might have been yesterday, days are running together, where the federal government announced that they're going to be fully implementing the Quarantine Act and leveling hefty penalties on anyone who is supposed to self-isolate when they come home and isn't.
There are these sort of old school sort of restrictions that we experience that the state can impose, and we've seen used in relative rarity. But there are moments in Canadian history where we have seen quarantines enacted at the level of the municipality or whatnot. But now we have it on a national level, and we have it on an open-ended basis, since we don't know how long this situation is going to last, and we just have to wait and see. There's an end game of a vaccine somewhere on the horizon, but we're seeing that trade-off. And one way to think about that is, if we look at Canadian rights, we are very trained to think of our rights as citizens under in the Charter era. We are also put right inside the document is the very first item in the Charter states that all rights are subject to reasonable restrictions or limits. And when we're in an emergency, it's up for debate whether what is reasonable to be restricted does not change. Right? So if we were used to robust freedom of movement at a time when many Canadians security of person is threatened by this virus or their lives in themselves, then perhaps it becomes reasonable to say we need to have stronger imposition on stronger restriction on some of these other rights that we're normally accustomed to. And then we have to see how far down that path are we willing to go.
Well, yeah, and security of person is, I have the Charter right above my computer, so I always look up at it. Security of the person's enshrined there in Section 7 versus, you know, the rights we usually think of, free speech and freedom of movement and democratic rights are some of the earlier ones. But for me, you know, this kind of creates the tension that we see in Western countries between, you know, we talk a lot about, or we think historically a lot about the individuality of or the liberty of the individual, but there's also this element of the social responsibility in a democratic state. And I think that has slipped at various times as people can't even be bothered to vote in some cases. But what we have here is a monumental task where every Canadian, you know, Adrian Dix every day is talking about, we need 100% commitment from 100% of the people to tackle this, which is something we have not been asked for as a society in years, to potentially going back to the Second World War.
Right. We are accustomed to thinking of the rights of the citizen. We talk less often about the duties of the citizen. And it is sort of founded on a different ethical principle. The idea is that in a liberal society, we all agree to limit some of our rights because it allows us to get what we want. There's sort of the social contract there, that idea that we will go along with taxes as long as we are assured everyone else is paying taxes and we get something out of it. But here we're doing something, it's a little bit different. We're not there is a sense in which if we don't take care of this virus, it could come and affect us personally, but it is even stronger its effect on many others in society. And so we're being asked to do our part as members of this society, protecting those who can't do it themselves and contributing something. And that's out of a sense of duty to community and any kind of reciprocity there is very generalized. And that's different than what we think about in terms of the more explicit sort of transactional nature that liberal rights-based talk sometimes the form it takes. We only constrain our rights because we're going to get something else out of the deal. For instance, we're going to pay our taxes and we're going to get something out of it. Here, we're going to take care of people in society because that's what we do as members of the society. There are other ways to frame it, but that's what it boils down to.
Right. So in this case, with the COVID-19 virus that the whole world is grappling with, what we've seen in places that we alluded to earlier with Taiwan, Singapore, and South Korea is that they've taken a very kind of top-down approach and are putting in a lot of restrictions. On the other hand, that does also seem to be like the one thing that's actually worked to one degree or another. How do we deal with the fact that, like, it's from the looks of it, we're going to need to go through a pretty restrictive period for quite a while for us to bend the curve and then keep it under control as we try and ease off all the restrictions?
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like we do have to think about this in phases, unless we are going to be this more sort of limited approach where we are still seeing hints in the US that is on the table, where the virus might just be left to go in some parts of the country and then not see a full response. And I don't think anyone's contemplating that here in Canada. But then if we want to deal with this virus as aggressively as we can, then yeah, there's this period of, we're not at the period of lockdown. The government wants to, is very clearly trying to limit the impositions it has to make on people. So it's asking people to comply out of a sense of duty rather than out of a sense of obligation, in the sense of you will go to jail or you will face a fine or something. So they don't want to take it to that next level of an state ordered lockdown, but I mean, it's on the table. But one way or another, we need to get to this phase that we're this place where the curve is bent. But even then, we're stuck with this challenge. So we bent the curve. Great. Most people are still at risk of catching this thing until some virus comes along down the line, and we think it may be 18 months, 2 years until that happens. And so, how are we going to live? The solution we're seeing in places like South Korea and Taiwan is they transfer additional powers to the state, effectively, to engage in increased monitoring of the population through things like technology. And that allows an opening up of some parts of society so people can venture back out and you can have some more normal interaction, but it's at a cost.
Right, because it allows the state there to basically identify anyone who's come in contact with an affected individual and then isolate them. So it allows them to break the transmission chains very effectively, as opposed to what's happening here right now, where we're trying to do that, but at a much coarser scale by just clamping down on every type of social gathering.
Right. Here right now, it's an admission. We don't know where all the chains are, so we're going to keep everyone home. Once you get past that stage where you have no new outbreaks for a period of weeks, I think it has to be, then you can perhaps start letting people out, but you still expect there will be new outbreaks, new chains of infection breaking out, and then you need a way to trace them effectively, and the tools we currently have just aren't up to that task, it seems like. So then do we look at more monitoring, or do we stick with a more restrictive set of limits on freedom of movement? It's what kind of restrictions are we going to accept? Are they going to be intrusions on privacy? Are they going to be limits on movement, some combination of the two? Are we going to go back and forth if there are fresh outbreaks? So we're going to have to come up with a sort of a plan of what kinds of freedoms are we willing to give up on this medium term phase in order to have some semblance of normal life and to try to move back towards some semblance of a normal economy, and also retain an understanding and a sense of why we had those rights in the first place and when we can expect to resume them. Or are there some rights we're going to give up on in the long term, where perhaps the state does take a more active role in maintaining the capacity to monitor, subject to things like additional transparency measures where its use is well documented, or citizens can sort of demand data about what does the government have on them, that sort of thing. So you can see what is being monitored and what use it's being put, and you have strong rules and regulations in place about what data can be accessed by what government department, under what circumstances, and subject to what demand. So you can start to build in a regime around a more flexible understanding of how that data can be used. But that's a door that's going to maybe more broadly opened. And we're going to have a conversation about what are Canadians comfortable with. And when individual security is on the line, then people are often willing to give up a little more in terms of freedoms. But we need to understand what is at stake there.
Right. And that's one of the tensions. And there seems to me a fairly strong case to take an approach similar to what's you're seeing in some of those Asian countries. But it's also something that I don't think anyone wants to see become a permanent fixture in Canada. So that then raises the question of, is there a way to do it in the short term and scale it back once the state of emergency has been lifted? And that can get kind of tricky.
Well, the other way I look at it is we're talking a lot so far about kind of the stick approach, like the how do we enforce compliance? But, we mentioned how BC has largely tried to appeal to people's sense of duty. And I think something that comes into play there is not just kind of asking people to stay home if they can, but actually taking steps to empower them. So things like the benefits that we talked about, the money that we talked about with Kevin Milligan rolling out to people to enable them that, if you're sick, the government's not going to, you can't be fired and you will have money to pay your bills. So do take your leave. I think those kind of approaches can go a long way to helping get not 100% compliance, but we can get quite a long ways when people don't feel desperate to take, go to work or to endanger others. Like when we have what I've been, honestly pretty impressed by the BC government's approach in terms of getting good information out there in a not, alarmist way, but in a way that kind of just appeals to people to say, this is bad. We need you to take your, do your part, whether that's being a healthcare worker and going to work or staying home, otherwise taking that social distancing and just kind of repeatedly hammering on that message and then providing financial and other means for people to take that leave. It kind of leaves us without having to resort to those draconian measures. Now, unfortunately, the government still seems to move to those, and I can't tell if much of that gets motivated by people angry on Twitter who are taking pictures of people out in fields.
Well, it's not just that. You could tell Dr. Bonnie Hendry was pretty angry that the dental conference, the now infamous one from March 6th and 7th, went ahead. That's a organization that in theory should be more attuned to the public health challenges. So it's not just people getting angry on social media. I think a clear enough sign that there was more needed to be done than just the public health officer urging action to be done. And it needed a combination of both carrots and sticks. And perhaps the government was a little slow on moving in this, rolling out the second half of that.
Yeah. I mean, it's clearly you need both. You need, to some extent, you need both, I guess, if we're doing it in three parts, the different pieces. You need to have some way to enable people to stay home. If they can't make the choice economically, then they're not going to do it. So that, yeah, having that rollout is important. You need to have a variety of appeals to people so that they do the right thing themselves. And make that choice and understanding why it is. And that's something else we've seen in countries that have experienced significant outbreaks in the past. And so, again, I keep coming back to South Korea, Hong Kong, and Taiwan seem to have had this experience with MERS. I guess it's, I don't know if that's how it's pronounced.
I think SARS was the bigger one for them.
SARS and MERS both, yeah.
Yeah.
But a broad experience with outbreaks that were not contained, that the chain was not initially contained. And so there is some cultural awareness that when an isolation is necessary, it's necessary. We've seen what happens when we don't get on top of these things. And so there is an understanding of that sort of that duty at a more a broad base level. You don't have to do quite so much persuasion to get people on board after it, the first time it doesn't work right. And then the next time you've learned as a society. And so that can be a piece of it too. But just like with taxation, it would be a lot harder for the government to collect tax if everybody tried to avoid it. Most people pay tax. They expect others will as well. But a few people may not. They just may not understand the logic. And so then you have these other resources available. And what we call virus peacetime, you could have an individual quarantine order for an individual person and have a process associated with that. But the government clearly feels with a few of these cases at the federal level, there's a concern anyways with, say, Canadians returning from the U.S., some of the snowbirds are not taking self-isolation seriously, that there needs to be additional resources available. So we're seeing a move to the Quarantine Act, to some of these more broad-based powers that allow for immediate action, in the same way that, if you know, when some people don't pay taxes, there is an enforcement mechanism there as well, even though most people do pay taxes most of the time.
Right.
Without Although, even really being asked.
With taxes, it's a little less urgent that stuff happens right away. And I don't want to play, you know, bat state epidemiologist here, but it does seem that a fairly consistent thing, both in Canada, Europe, and especially the United States, is that governments were kind of a little slow to react and are, in some cases, seem to be, you know, a little behind where they should be. And I do have to wonder if it would have been better to start rolling out the quarantine at, 2 weeks ago when there was the request started to be made for people to stay home for 2 weeks after coming back, and before it became a mandate.
Yeah, it's a difficult thing to engage in, and so hindsight being 2020 and whatnot. So we did go through a period where the cases were being traced and where new arrivals seemed to be when a virus arrived on Canada shores, we had a tracing going on, and that seemed to work for a time. It's hard to go back and say we should have locked down the country at that moment. For one thing, it's hard to say, would people have even gone for it? And I'm not saying the government consciously sat down and said, you know what, we need to play this out until people get really scared, and then we can do this. But it's just more of a question of they were trying to take the maximal action that they thought they could at a given moment in time. I assume there were discussions along these lines, but there's also just an uncertainty about the future. It doesn't. We could see the curves happening in other countries, but until it starts to take hold here, it's difficult to take that next step and that next action, at least without having that broader experience in society. Like the last time we had an experience like this, if we go back to SARS, Canada was broadly successful at isolating it. So when we talk about, we heard a lot about learning the lessons of SARS, those are the lessons we learned. We didn't learn about what happens when SARS jumps the barrier and it makes it into the broader population. And we have infection rates, you know, with hundreds of people across the country in different provinces and more than that.
Well, I just want to interrupt our conversation for some breaking mid-podcast news, which will not be lot breaking for people listening, but it's more fun to do it this way because we're just discovering it now. The Conservative Leadership Committee has officially suspended the leadership race of the Conservative Party of Canada until at least May 1st, when they will reevaluate the situation.
Dun, dun, dun.
Reactions.
It's about time. They had to do this. The writing was on the wall. And how can you have a political convention when you can't even have like a baseball season, right? It seemed like it was just operating in a separate track from the rest of society for the last week or so, when everyone else was aware that like everything has to change. We are not in. So I'm going to try to make this virus peacetime, virus war time a thing maybe. But this is not normal situation. You can't just assume you can get away with all the stuff you're normally doing and accomplish all your goals at this time. You have to be aware of this broader situation. And the Conservatives, as the party in government in waiting, they have to be acting. And the leaders, those vying for the leadership, are auditioning for the role of prime minister. They have to act in a statesmanlike way and in some respect. And so when there is a clear and present threat to the country, then you have to act like it.
Yeah, and we've seen some of them step up to that and call for the leadership race to continue. And, well, we've seen Peter McKay want to push ahead regardless.
He actually, I think, wanted it accelerated.
Yeah.
It was not a great look.
No, neither was the interview he did earlier today where he was asking Evan Solomon, why don't you go ask the other candidates why they want to have it delayed, and right. Didn't seem to accept that a pandemic was a decent enough reason to delay it.
Right. To assume that people citing the pandemic is really a way to secure a position in the conservative leadership race is really, I think, not in touch with where the rest of the country, including others in the race, are. It's just hopefully he takes a little time now to see what is going on around him, because he doesn't have to campaign anymore for a while.
Maybe bring on an entire new Tom staff.
Well, maybe. I don't know. Do they do that once already? I feel like they needed to do that a while ago.
You still run the same people.
Race had winnowed somewhat. After the latest threshold went by, only Peter McKay, Aaron O'Toole, Derek Sloan, and Leslyn Lewis crossed the number of required signatures and amount of money. Marilyn Gladue couldn't pull it all together, and Jim Karahelios was actually disbarred and kicked out of the race for undisclosed reasons, but it's largely presumed it's because he said some racist things about other people and shared some racist memes on his Facebook page. Too racist for the Conservative Party, that is.
Right. And out of those who've made it through, I think Aaron O'Toole is kind of the only one that so far to me stood out as the one actually acting like a potential prime minister rather than everyone else who's been kind of scrambling around trying to make it all too political. Although even he's probably thrown a few more barbs the Liberals' way than is really called for in the current situation.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because in this moment, there is a really important role for the opposition. And we actually saw that on full display this week. And I thought the opposition actually rose to the occasion quite well when we had the Liberals bring forward, what was it called, C-13, the COVID relief bill, effectively, and the emergency measures that were contained in it. One of them was this idea that apparently the idea that the finance minister was going to have the power to unilaterally raise and lower taxes, effectively taking over the power of the purse from Parliament until 2021. That is the fundamental bedrock of parliamentary powers, that they get to decide if the government is going to get the money it needs for its program. And just to ask the legislature to hand that over was essentially to put parliamentary democracy into abeyance in an important way. And the opposition rightly said, no, we're not going to do that. We have to find ways to make sure this government can move quickly to respond. But that's not going to be one of those ways. We're going to retain the rights and duties of this House to hold the government to account in its request for spending and its plans for spending. And they're going to do so on behalf of Canadians. And that in a time where government is taking unprecedented actions on a number of fronts, you need to have an active opposition asking important, difficult, serious questions, but also supporting the government when it has good ideas about how to respond. It needs to do both those things at once. And I thought this week, actually, from what we could see of what went on in those negotiations, did that fairly effectively.
Well, and it was such a different approach than seems to have happened here in British Columbia, where they've been working the government and at least the Green Caucus for 3 years on every bill. And from time to time, I suspect with the BC Liberals. And we saw that with the aid package that was rolled out here, with all parties agreeing and signing a letter in support of it before it was even tabled in the legislature, and all parties agreeing to essentially step down the number of MLAs who went to the legislature, because the Liberals could have easily sprung a trap and knocked the government down, but that would have been a very bad election for them if they forced it in this situation.
Yeah.
And they only had two Liberal MLAs in the legislature. Well, the NDP got a de facto majority for one really bizarre friendly sitting.
Well, yeah, and the seriousness of the situation requires people to change their scripts. This is not a time for opposition for the sake of opposition. It's not clear anyone could win an election that was called now, because it's not clear how we would hold an election at this moment. We'd obviously have to find a way. If the government fell, the business of government has to continue, but it would be difficult for Canadians. And we might see the vast majority of ballots cast by mail or something like that. And then nobody wants to have to go through those kinds of circumstances. And so, we're not sort of in the classic unity government of wartime, but we're also not in the normal everyday business and politics either. And we're seeing an awareness of that on multiple fronts. And I think that's to the credit of Canada's politicians. Here in BC, that was a remarkable show of unity. But even in Ottawa, that we've seen a willingness to compromise, and the Liberals back down from some of their from that particular clause in particular. We don't know what else happened in those negotiations, but in the end, everyone signed off on this this relief emergency bill, and it went forward. And now we have a whole array of monies available to Canada, and we have additional capacities for the government to respond. So that's I think that's a win.
Yeah, it's I think being reassuring to watch political leadership kind of across the country more or less rise to the occasion. I mean, there's been missteps, like we talked about with the Liberals just now. But, even the more populist premiers, who there was always a question how well they'd handle a real crisis, have done well. I mean, Doug Ford has, I think, surprised even his critics by how he's responded to this. And yeah, overall, I think it speaks well to the position Canada's in.
And even outside COVID-related news, today we just saw the BCTF reach a tentative agreement with the province, so there might not be a province-wide teacher strike on top of all of this.
Now, if only my kids could go back to school.
Some children might get to go back to classes, but that's probably only for emergency and healthcare workers. Your kids are going to have to learn from home. I'm sorry, Stuart.
No, it's all right. My six-year-old has gone around. He's labeled every bit of the house. So the kitchen now has a sign on it that says lunchroom and so on all the way around the house. So we're making it work.
All right. I think that's where we'll leave it.
Thanks for the chat.
And that has been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. Support the show and get access to our Slack channel at patreon.com/politicoast. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Napotnikov. Politicoast is a production of Leg and Boot Media, and editing services are provided by CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. Wash your hands and stay home. Thanks for listening.